You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild. Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Today on The Grave Talks, a conversation about one night in Salem, the hidden history of the American witch, a new book by Troy Taylor. In his new book, Troy Taylor reveals the hidden history of the American witch, looking back to when witchcraft came to America with the first European settlers. They had fled from home at a time when thousands were being accused, tortured, hanged, and burned for being witches. They came to America for a fresh start and brought that fear of witches with them. That fear and dread became hysteria when evil came to Salem Village, fueling hostility, distrust, and religious fanaticism that claimed the lives of innocent people on the gallows. But Salem was not the end of America's obsession with witchcraft. I'm Carol Hughes, and on this episode of The Grave Talks, we'll look back on the hidden history of the American witch and how it continues today with author Troy Taylor. Troy, thank you so much for being on the show today. And off, did I read this right? Have you written around 90 books?
No. It's closer to 140 now.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not
kidding. 140 books.
Yeah, I really need to get an exact count. It sort of got lost between 130 and 140, and I'm not sure exactly where it is because I just quit counting. But yeah, it's.
But did you start when you were like five?
I wish. No, actually, this month is my 30th anniversary in writing as a writer and in being in the ghost business. So American Hauntings celebrated 30 years this month. So
you are the founder of American Hauntings and you are an author, as we just established. Let me rephrase that, a prolific author, podcaster. You do ghost tours, ghost hunts. You've definitely gone into the paranormal world as a career. What got you interested in the paranormal world? Did it start, I'm assuming, when you were a kid?
Yeah, for sure. I've always been interested in this kind of stuff. It wasn't any one experience, really. It was sort of an ongoing experience. My great-grandfather was a police officer and an Irish immigrant. And he used to sit me down and tell me all the stories about not only the, you know, the criminal stuff that he was, I was too young at the time, the criminal stuff that he dealt with in his career, but also all these old ghost stories and folk legends, and some he'd brought from home, some that were local to where we lived and where I was growing up. And it just sort of soaked into me. And as the years went by, I kept thinking, you know, he told me all these stories, but I don't think anybody's ever written this stuff down. So I started to write locally about Central Illinois, where I was growing up. And like I said, that was 30 years ago. And I just kept doing it. I've just never quit. Most people kind of outgrow that idea of, you know, being fascinated with ghosts and unsolved mysteries and things like that. But I've just grown older. I have never grown up. So I just found a way to do it as a career. And I love it. It's not like having a real job, even though it is one. You and I were talking earlier about, you know, how do you find time for all this stuff? And, you know, it's my full-time job. This is what I do pretty much every day. I mean, obviously, weekends, I'm not always here. I try to spend a little time in the evening not working if I can. But, you know, I love doing it. I never dread coming to work in the morning. I just keep writing, keep putting things together, keep doing new tours, whatever, you know, dinners, all it. It's just fun.
You do everything.
It really is. Yeah.
Now let's talk about the latest book. It just came out the end of March, and it's about witches.
Yes.
So The One Night in Salem, The Hidden History of the American Witch, this goes way back. So you start with going to Europe. When witches came here, they were fleeing persecution there. Or I should say when people came here.
This is right. This is a little outside of what I normally do. This is just it's something that was a project that I got interested in. And it's a little outside my normal, you know, ghosts and true crime and just straight history kind of stuff that I normally write. But, you know, and of course, then you'll find all this true crime in the book. So even so, I still, you know, get back to my roots. But this story, it's always fascinated me because, you know, people in Europe at the time were, you know, the Spanish Inquisition came along, people were being accused of witchcraft. But the main part of it had been really just the establishment of, you know, the governments and the church at the time telling people what they could and couldn't do. And a lot of our roots of witchcraft go back to, you know, the pagans, the, you know, worshiping nature and, you know, and that sort of thing. And that wasn't right for the church. They wanted everyone to do the same thing. They wanted them all to be part of, you know, the Christian establishment. And people didn't want to do that. And eventually they began to be accused of things that they really weren't doing, you know, because if it wasn't the church, it was evil. And it was the devil. So if these people were worshiping the devil, then they must be witches because, you know, in the King James version of the Bible, it says that thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, even though that's a mistranslation. But we'll leave all that alone for now. Let's just say that that's what all this was based on. And so people began to be persecuted for their beliefs or lack of beliefs. But they weren't really witches. They were prosecuting people for not following religion at the time. But that allowed people to tie the devil into witchcraft and to magic and folk magic and that kind of thing, which were very common things at the time. You know, folk medicine and folk magic at the time was something that was widely accepted by people and would be in this country as well, because when the settlers came over here, the first colonists who came looking for religious freedom came over here and then decided to impose their religion on everyone else. So they essentially did the same thing that had been done to them. But when they got here, one of the, you know, even more so than just witches, the one thing that the Puritans of the time, who are responsible for all of the New England witch trials, their one thing they feared more than anything else was folk magic and folk medicine, because people were looking for cures. Doctors at the time were fairly useless. And so things they were finding could help people were what the folk healers were offering. And the church just wanted people to pray, to feel better. The Puritans, that's what they believed. If you wanted to be cured from your illness or your problems, that you just needed to pray harder. So they needed to stop and shut down, you know, the folk magic practitioners of the time. And so they tied it all into witchcraft and they tied it all into the devil. And that, of course, made it evil. And, you know, hysteria broke out all over New England at the time. And it was pretty much confined in New England, which is why I always blame it on the Puritans and their fanaticism, because that's where all the problems were coming from.
Well, and the Puritans definitely were fanatics.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, there's no question about it. They were America's really homegrown fanatics, our original anyway. We've had a lot more since then, believe me, but as you know, but they were our first, and they were the ones who really kick things off with, you know, a lot of violence, torture, trials, hangings, you know, everything you can imagine. It came out of their religious beliefs. And what happened in Salem was sort of a perfect storm, but Salem was far from the only place where witch trials and accusations were taking place. It was all over Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts, Rhode Island. There were people being accused everywhere. And Salem really was kind of at the end of the line for all this. There had been a pause for years where no one had been, there had been some accusations made because, you know, accusing someone of being a witch, you'll find that when you start going through some of these records and stories, really didn't usually have much to do with people thinking they were actual witches.
Right. It's not like what we think of as witches.
Old, you know, eccentric people, folk healers, people mostly just with bad personalities. I mean, mean people. Yeah. If you didn't get along with somebody, you'd get your revenge by accusing them of being a witch. Mm-hmm. You know, neighborhood disputes, land disputes, things about money, all of that. If you accuse somebody of being a witch, there was a good chance that you would get your revenge because these people might be, you know, if not hanged, they'd at least be brought to trial and humiliated in the village or in the town. I mean, it didn't happen in just villages or on farms. It was in big cities like Boston and places too. But, you know, people would be accused for a variety of reasons and very few of them had anything to do with witchcraft. But for years, there hadn't been anything. Things got quiet in the late 1600s because we had other things to worry about. Believe it or not, we had wars that were going on among the settlers and the Native Americans at the time that we don't even study in history classes anymore. I mean, really bad ones, like the King Philip's War, which led to the decimation of like 20% of the Native American population in the entire colonies at the time. It was a lot of people, but we've kind of forgotten about those things. But that became more important than witchcraft. And then along came Salem. And Salem was, like I said, kind of a perfect storm of a village that was divided up into factions, families who didn't get along with each other. You know, a lot of the problems that, you know, they'd had problems with Native Americans. They'd had problems with weather. They'd had problem with the crops. And so one side would turn more toward God, hoping that could, you know, cure all their ills. There were plenty of people in town who, you know, practiced folk medicine, folk magic. And then, you know, things just got out of control. Mostly thanks to a servant who belonged to Reverend Samuel Parris, whose name was Tituba. She was a transplant from the West Indies. She was a household slave at a time when, you know, slavery wasn't just in the South. It could be anywhere back in those days when we were still a British colony. And, you know, she entertained a couple of bored girls in the middle of winter with, you know, a few magic tricks, essentially, and a little bit of folk magic from the islands where she had grown up. And, you know, they told their friends and their friends knew they were going to get in trouble. And one thing led to another. And these girls began accusing people. I mean, first, I think it started out as a prank, you know, just to get out of trouble, not necessarily a prank, but an excuse, because they were doing something they knew they weren't supposed to do as young Puritan young women. And they got in trouble for it. And so they decided to act like they were being afflicted by someone. Well, now the adults were getting in on it and they were demanding that they name who it was that was causing them problems. And so they were stuck between a rock and a hard place. And then boy, once they got started, they couldn't stop. You know, it just kept growing and snowballing. And the, you know, the hysteria in the village and the fanaticism of the Puritans turned it into something that it never should have been. These girls were, you know, putting on a huge show because it was either that or, you know, they were going to get in trouble themselves. And when they started hanging people, I can guarantee you they weren't going to stop, because if they had and admitted what they'd done, they probably would have been hanged themselves. So It was just a perfect storm of that had nothing. Honestly, it had everything to do with witchcraft, but it didn't really have anything to do with actual witches, because none of those people who died at Salem were witches. I don't think there was anyone in that village other than maybe Tituba and probably a few other people who practiced, you know, folk healing, who knew anything about what we consider witchcraft. And it ended up with 19 people being hanged. And of course, Jos Corey, who was crushed to death underneath stones because he was being tortured because he wouldn't speak at his trial. So yeah, it's a, and I thought that, you know, that made a perfect title for this book, because that's what people think of in America when we think of witches. I mean, even when Bewitched came out, they did a couple of episodes in Salem. And you might remember when an American Horror Story, when they did the which is their best season, Coven, you'll remember that the witches fled from Salem and ended up in New Orleans. You know, so it's, you know, it's funny that they'd use that, but it fits. And that's what we think of. But there's just so much more to the story, you know, some before Salem, but so much that really has to do with witches and magic that came after Salem.
Right. That's interesting, because when you think of American witches, Salem probably jumps right to the forefront of most people's brains. They think of Salem. And as you said, they really weren't even witches. And some of that could have been, you know, some of the young girls having fits, and I'm using air quotes.
Sure.
That could have been caught. That could have been a medical issue. They could have, you know, when you consider foods that they ate, you know, it's not the same as what we eat today. Right. And they could have been exposed to any number of things that could have caused those things. And then you've got this Puritan religion, also using air quotes on that, who brutally murdered that man by putting stones on top of stones on top of stones until he was crushed to death, hanged women for really no cause. And that's what we think of as witches. They really
were. But they were doing what they thought was the right thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there have been, as you mentioned, lots of different suggestions as to what caused it, that the hysteria was caused by, you know, something, the ergon on the wheat or something like that. But honestly, I don't think it's that hard. I think we try too hard to give an explanation. I think what this was nothing but something that started out as a prank and turned into hysteria. Mental illness, or not even illness, not even illness, but mental conditions that when people believe something so much, I mean, you know, I don't think it's much different than all the 700 and some people who drank the Flavor Aid at Jonestown. They really believe they were doing the right thing. And I think these girls believed the same thing, and it became contagious and spread throughout this village that already had its own problems with people not getting along and issues. And I think that it was taken advantage of by the religious authorities, who were going to get rid of, you know, any kind of, you know, evil that had, you know, penetrated their village. And I think that it just spun out of control. And I think these people really believed what they were doing was the right thing. But the religious authorities were the ones who caused it. I really do genuinely believe that. I don't think it had anything to do with, you know, any kind of poisoning or even an illness. I think the fits were mentally caused. I really do. But I mean, that's my opinion. But I tried to approach all of this. I mean, this is not like a how-to book on how to be a witch or anything.
No.
it's a history book, and that's what it was meant to be. I couldn't write a book about witches and practicing magic and things, because I don't really know anything about that. But I know a lot about history, and that was how I wanted to approach this, as to say, these were real events. You know, the people who believe that they are actually causing things to happen with their folk magic or with their various type of magic are real people. And they truly believe these things. And, you know, the more you believe when it comes to sympathetic magic, if you believe it, it's got a much better chance of working. But Salem just doesn't have anything to do with magic. It just doesn't.
How did they get that under control? It was so out of control for a while in a frenzy. And she's a witch and he's a witch and she's a witch.
Right, right.
How did they end up getting that under control?
Yeah, we talk about the 20 people who died, but again, there were dozens and dozens of people, hundreds of people who were accused and placed in jail to await trial. Eventually, there was a new governor came to Massachusetts. And at first, he didn't really know what was going on. He came through Salem with little interest in what was happening in the village. He was really just passing through, trying to round up a few men to go with him to Canada, where they were going to launch an attack against the French. That's really all he had in mind. So when people came to him and said, "Hey, you got to help us out with this. We've got witches all over the place." And he's like, "You do." And he sees how many people are in jail. And he says, "Well, listen, I'm going to appoint a committee to come in and see if we can't get this figured out." Unfortunately, the committee made things worse. They're the ones who actually started the trials. Up until that point, they were just hearings and deciding who was going to go to jail and wait to go on trial. But now the governor actually got the trial started. I don't think that's what he had in mind, because when he returned from Canada and came back and found that things were even worse, now people had been hanged and there were even more people in jail, it was just like, okay, enough is enough. This has got to stop. And they released everyone from jail, except for a handful of people who still had to, according to Puritan law, be brought to trial. But most of them were let go. The biggest problem was that witnesses were coming to trial and claiming that they were seeing the specters of the witches. These ghostly figures were being projected from the witches themselves, and they were the ones wreaking havoc. But the only people that could see these specters were the people who were being attacked by them. Now, this was allowed as actual evidence in the trials. Well, when the governor found this out, he says, oh no, we can't do this. And so finally, after he spoke out, more people began to speak out, and eventually they put the trials to an end. People came to trial. They were allowed to go free. There were only two people out of, I believe, about 150 sitting in jail who they decided really, you know, might be guilty. They were found guilty of being witches, and the governor just commuted the sentence and sent them on their way. So that's kind of what brought it to an end. I mean, it went on for a long time, but he finally just got it stopped. And that became the last big incident, although I recount a lot more. You know, when we think of the witch trials, there were still a few more that followed, but for the most part, it started to die away. But by the next century, into the 1800s, there were still people being accused of witches all over the country. And I go through and talk about a lot of those. And most of them were silly. Most of them were accusations not made against people. I mean, maybe some of the people had been practicing some kind of folk magic or something. But for the most part, it was the same thing that had gone on for years. People who were angry at someone because they felt they cheated them, or, you know, angry over land deals, all kinds of stuff. I mean, there's even categories of people who are being accused of witches, the accidental witches, the people who were accused because they were elderly. You know, it happened, and it continued to happen for a long time. Eventually, there would be people who would begin to bill themselves as witches, but you didn't do that in the early 18, you know, into the 1600s, 17 and 1800s, you didn't want anybody to think you were a witch. Eventually, by the turn of the last century, that became kind of a good thing. It was good for your business if you decided you were a witch one day, which sounds kind of crazy in comparison to some of the other stuff. But Salem didn't really end anything. It just changed it. Honestly, that's probably the best way to describe it.
So anybody who did practice any sort of folk magic, you know, like the woman you mentioned who grew up like that, did they kind of go underground at that point, or did you even dive into that at all?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. They did, because there were a lot of people who were practicing folk magic, at the time and definitely after. Now, a lot of those were, you know, people not necessarily New England as much. When you hear about folk magic these days, even its history, most of that seems to be centered either in the Ozark region or in mostly in the Appalachians. That seems to be where a lot of the folk magic ended up and where most of the practitioners were. And it became a big part of their culture. Now, most of the settlers who came to that area came from Ireland, Scotland, a lot of the Bohemian, as they called them that, at that time, countries. And they came here, blended their beliefs that they brought from home with the Native Americans who were here at the time. And they created sort of their own type of practice. And there are lots, and I go into that quite a bit in the book as far as the things they believed in, the things they did, the things that they would use to kind of help things along. And it had to do with everything, life, death, giving birth to babies, when you were sick. And, you know, we probably call it more, I mean, we still call it folk magic because it was generally folk magic, the conjure folk, as they often called them, were really just folks. And they took what was brought here from England and turned it into a purely American type of witchcraft. I mean, that's what I would call folk magic. That's how I describe it in the book. They were just ordinary people who were using everything from herbs to spices to salts to different waters and creating their own, you know, magic from it, their own spells, their own beliefs. And as I mentioned already, sympathetic magic, which is really essentially what this is, the more you believe in it, the better it works. And there have been thousands of documented accounts of, you know, spells given to people, magic potions, you name it, that work because the people who use them believe that they do work. And that is important. And because of that, I went on to talk about that type of folk magic. I talk about Pennsylvania hex magic, which is very powwowing, as they called it. It is very close, but it's fascinating.
What does that mean, powwowing?
Well, that's what they called it. And it was a term that was taken from the Native Americans because the Pennsylvania type of hex magic was mostly German immigrants. And they came to Pennsylvania, and that's where they largely settled. And, you know, we had the Amish there, the Mennonites, and then there were the Germans who believed in what was called hexerei, which was a type of folk magic. And powwowing, they called them powwowers, or powwowing was a type of medicine that was mostly about healing. They were mostly healers. That's what they did. And long generations of families, a whole line of family members would become powwowers, and they would pass their knowledge on from generation to generation. There were books that were created. The sixth and seventh book of Moses was a very important book to some of the powwowers. There was also The Long Lost Friend, which was a book that was essentially a spell book. Both of those are still available. You can still get copies of them today, but they began to be printed in the early 1800s, and they were found on the shelf of every powwower around. Now, when we think of hex magic, we think of, you know, those hex signs that you see on barns sometimes, especially if you're in Pennsylvania or in a rural area. But those were the funny story about those big hex signs on barns. Those were an invention from the 1940s. They don't have anything to do with magic, but or hexes. But they look cool on barns. But somewhere along the line, they got confused and mixed in there. But so essentially it was about healing. It has a really interesting history. And that's where, unfortunately, a lot of our true crime comes in, because there were a couple of different hex murders that took place in the 1920s and 30s. So this wasn't, we're not talking about ancient old American history here. We're talking about fairly recent, less than 100 years ago. There was a young man who believed he'd been hexed by a powwower who had been around for a long time, and he murdered him with help from his friends and believed that it was self-defense because he thought this guy had put a spell on him. The same thing happened a few years later. And this guy believed that a woman had hexed him several years before, and he went out to her house and shot her through the window and killed her. He was caught a couple of days later, and there were so many people in town where he lived, where this happened, who believed that woman had actually been an evil powwower that they gathered money for his defense and actually tried to help him out. He was a local hero because he killed this woman. So all of that stuff, I mean, it's the belief system is there. I mean, it's all related. Our American form of witchcraft is different than anywhere else in the world, because what we have done is anytime it comes to our country, we turn it into something else that makes it uniquely American, like the powwowing, or like just Appalachian folk magic, or voodoo and hoodoo, also types of folk magic that came from somewhere else. And when it got to our country, we turned it into another thing. It's all fascinating. And I just had such a great time writing this book. And I think part of it was that, you know, it's not what I normally deal with. And so it was a lot of fun for me to dig into old newspaper stories about, you know, people who were, you know, accused of being witches or were shot because somebody thought they were a witch. And, you know, just to see how it all took root here and became what it has become.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation with author Troy Taylor. We've been talking about his latest book, One Night in Salem, The Hidden History of the American Witch. You can find out more about Troy and all of his books at AmericanHauntingsInc.com. And if you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advanced episodes, everything commercial free, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts. You can try it there for free for 3 days. You can also go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. Find everything there, also all ad free. From all of us here at The Grave Talks, I'm Carol Hughes. Thank you for listening.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.